Thank you for joining us today. This is a conversation between the Child Health Advisory Council of Career Physician. We're a group of experienced leaders who get together regularly to discuss leadership and how we might contribute to the success of leaders in pediatrics in the future. Today, our conversation will include our council, who consists of Valerie Opapari, Danielle LaRocca-Rina, Arnold Strauss, Craig Hillemeyer, Robert Sowen, Chris Gleason, and Renee Jenkins. We really enjoy getting together and sharing ideas. One of the topics that's come up in correspondence, actually, from people who participated in our previous webinars is the issue of faculty retention. And all of us agree this is a very important issue facing academic medicine. It turns out that it's been shown that within the first 5 to 7 years, nearly 40% of academic appointees leave academics. And this is particularly prevalent among young physicians and assistant professor appointees for their first academic appointment. And so this is a tremendous loss of talent, the ability to meet a department's mission. It's a huge financial cost to the departments because of the investment one made to recruit someone and the investment it takes to replace that person. And it also has a significant issue of affecting the morale negatively, because all of us want people who come to work with us to succeed and to feel welcomed. And when they're lost, it has a huge impact. What are some of the thoughts of our council, Bob? What are some of the things that are important to you as you consider faculty retention?
I wonder whether in some of our conversations about mentorship, whether purposely engaging a mentor during a recruitment is a prudent thing to do. I know at our school, the dean often assigns a colleague chair of another department to serve as a mentor for a new chair. And I think having that mentor assigned on the front end might be a really important tool.
I always thought that trying to find future colleagues for the individual who we're recruiting and getting them engaged in being accessible to the recruit. We have to be careful, obviously, about what questions we ask, trying to understand what the needs of a recruit are. Wesley, do you have any thoughts about how a search firm differs from a department in trying to gain understanding of what the needs of a recruit are that might lead to retention?
There's always, I think, faculty paranoia about questions that can and can't be asked for the legal reasons related to search and employment law and things of that nature. You know, your firm partner really should be able not only to provide a window into the professional needs of candidates, but also the personal needs, you know, the family needs, which can be professional for, a dual professional family. And a lot of those things, how you engage the spouse, how you engage the family in your process, and getting feedback throughout the process as to how you are doing in engaging a candidate and their families it just elevates the level, the chemistry level, if you will, that a candidate comes into the role with. And I think that, you know, it'll be that chemistry that carries them on into the relationship. And so I do think a firm should play that role for any of its partners in really helping to, while you're recruiting the candidate, at the end of the day, you really should be recruiting the whole family. And I think they can play that bridge role until the appropriate time for you to take over the relationship.
Thanks. There's an aspect that I undervalued for many years, and that was the importance of getting off to a good start, particularly onboarding. When I became a faculty member, I was told the first day to go down to clinic and see patients. What sort of initial efforts did our panelists make over time? That changed, by the way, with time. For example, I went to a seminar one time, which I've learned a lot from business seminars, and they said at this seminar that the first 90 days had a huge impact on someone's interest in retaining with an organization. And so we started a 30 and 90 day, four to five question meeting with the division chief and a new faculty appointment, and a 90 day with the chair. And it made a huge difference. It really created a very safe interest opportunity for a leader in the new appointment to sit down and say, how are things going? Are there things that you didn't expect? Are you concerned at all about your job? And we found that quite useful. What did others do?
Yeah, I agree completely, Bruder. I think the interaction early on is critical, interaction with the leadership. So whether it's the division director, the department chair, or a section chief, it's really important to set up a regular interaction in the first, I would say, 6 months that involves those kinds of questions, but also is a bi-directional conversation. So not just what are you, the recruit or the new faculty member, experiencing and expecting, but here's what we have seen from you, in whether it's positive or not, to make sure that there's a open conversation. And I think that's the issue that often impairs retention, is that there's not an open conversation, and that trust is not built in that first 6 months. So I think the interactions are crucial with the leadership, and that expresses an interest in the long-term outcome for the new faculty member.
And Bruder, I think it's really important that that interest be expressed in a formal way, and that the recruit understands that their success is really important to you and the department, and that it not be casual interactions, that there really be sort of a formal timeline at which people look at what the recruit's expectations were, what the department's expectations were, and how progress is being made towards meeting those expectations. And that fits really well with the concept of having mentorship, formal mentorship, to make sure that those things are happening. Because if they're not set up in a formal guideline, they tend to slip into less urgent priority and then not happen. And it's really important that those conversations take place in order to ensure the success of the recruit.
Bruder, I want to roll back a little bit to where you first started, which is, you know, how does recruitment lead to retention? I had the opportunity recently to speak to a junior colleague who was seeking his first position, faculty position, and he was referred to me for that discussion, and I didn't know him before. And it was fascinating, because what I suggested to him is to, had he discussed, you know, the institutions, and there were a number, he was a commitment to him and his career trajectory. And he was actually surprised, because he had sought, you know, advice around the various interviews. And as we can remember, our first junior appointments, we're anxious to see if we can get a good appointment, et cetera, and they like us, et cetera, et cetera. But he had not considered his own needs and what he might lay out as the kinds of support. So I think showing that at the interview process, to say that there is a commitment to this individual, then leads to the kinds of things that Arnie and Craig mentioned, which is a structured mentorship and a timeline and, you know, the desire to keep this person really for career. And, you know, there will be changes, and we can talk about why changes occur later. But that was something that really struck me, that he had not gotten that advice, that he mattered, okay? He mattered in this process.
I love Arnie's view of retention, in that it's proactive. And whenever he talks about this, I'm always reminded of how important the very first interviews are with the candidates. And I used to always like to emphasize the fact that the recruitment was a partnership, and that, you know, they have to feel your excitement for their recruitment, and you have to do as Danielle's suggesting, you really have to understand what their needs are. But I used to always like to tell individuals, you know, we're going to get some things onto paper and make some commitments and some promises, but you're on a journey in your career. And how we view things today is not going to be how things might be viewed in 6 months or 2 years or 3 years. And that partnership, it's really important that you remember that I'm here to help you and support you, and that your success is the success of the department. And I think your process, Bruder, of having the 30 and the 90 day meetings kind of scheduled is a good thing. But they can't just stop at 90 days because, you know, you're looking at, hopefully, as a young assistant professor, we're working on your first 8 to 10 year trajectory. So this is a journey we're going to take together. And, you know, being involved and building on that relationship and building the trust that comes from a successful recruitment through that kind of partnership is really critical. And it starts right at the very beginning, but it doesn't end with people signing on the dotted line. In fact, I think the work starts after that, the real work to be successful and to proactively retain people, as Arnie likes to say.
That's a great point. I always said to interview each applicant and let them know the chair was interested and involved. I also tried to indicate and usually made the statement, my goal was to, for them at 5 years in our department, to say they made the right decision, that this was the very best choice they could have made because they were successful and we had taken care of them.
I must say that I built a lot on what Valerie said about a partnership, because in recruiting faculty to my division, I had a certain number of immediate needs, you know, both research and clinical, administrative, you know, leaders within the research enterprise, the clinical enterprise, education, fellowship program. And in recruiting people, I really didn't want to fall into any kind of a trap where I was promising that they would get this, or this is what they needed, and this is what, and I needed that at the time. They wanted to be, for example, you know, a research director, or they wanted to be a fellowship training program director, and I needed that, and yet it was very clear that we were growing as a division, and that the needs of the division and the department might change, and their own needs and their evolution, their professional career might change. And so to me, that was a very, I learned a lot actually working with Bruder on this, because, you know, I needed a lot of advice, because the last thing I wanted was to bring in faculty who would say, well, you promised, you said, and it's not happening, or I didn't get that, or somebody else actually got that. And so that whole thing about a partnership, I thought, was very important. And the other thing that I know a lot of these, and I agree with everyone that has spoken about formal processes for checking in 30, 90 days, 6 months, you know, and a continuing process to evaluate, how are you doing? How are we doing as a division? And are we meeting each other's needs and so forth? Very important. But I also think that the, I guess for lack of a better term, more informal connections were something that I really found very important, especially as the division got bigger and bigger. I had a neonatal division, and it just got bigger and bigger with people doing almost different tracks, you know, a clinical track, research track, educational scholarship track, and administrative track, even within the department or the school. I found it was really important to get everybody together, both onboarding, and I hate to use the term social functions, but it was like that. You know how they always say, you know, do you have a best friend at work? Well, I think that engagement of all the rest of the faculty in my division, both in the recruitment and the onboarding and forming, not cliques or anything, but support groups, that was very important. And sometimes the group would come to me and say, you know, so-and-so is not happy with this, or, you know, And that would be very important advice for me to sort of know. They would be like my sort of like my vice chairs or whatever, not spies or anything, but you would find that out more through social interactions. I always had retreats, you know, every year until it got too big and we couldn't actually all get together in one place and who was going to cover all the, you know, 10 NICUs that we had and so forth. But in any case, I found that to be a very important part of retention, is getting to know people personally, making them feel they were part of sort of a family, a team, and so forth. So I thought that was very important.
And Bruder, I would add to what Christine said about the family environment, thinking about it as a collective good. So it's not just about the new recruit. It's about how that person interacts with the rest of the team, and that it is a team. And that when the team is successful, that means every individual is also successful. So the sort of collective thinking, I think, is critical to retention. People, the recruits who become very self-focused, I think, end up in trouble because they're more focused on their own individual personal accomplishments rather than the success of the entity. And in the end, the success of the entity benefits all of the participants.
All these are concepts are really important and well stated. I just wanted to make a plea for, as a proceduralist, that this same sort of approach be applied in the, you know, cath lab or the operating room or wherever, and making it a formal structure, not appearing as though you're having to monitor someone because you're concerned about their competency, but rather this is how we do it. And it gets to the point Bruder made about, you know, you're not just sending them to the cath lab or to the OR to start their day. You're introducing them, you're showing them how processes work, and you're there to support them and help make sure that they're confident, because getting off on the wrong foot as a proceduralist at a new institution can be a difficult thing to overcome.
It's sometimes just little things that you do often that continue to send the message that you value people. And so I would add to this conversation, you know, how do you celebrate the little accomplishments, the collective accomplishments? How do you recognize people along that journey they're taking with you? Because we don't do enough of that. And I think it's incredibly important to everyone to know that your accomplishments are valued and people notice them and recognize them. If you don't celebrate these things, what I think you find is people just don't feel like they're part of that community and that your accomplishments are just taken for granted. And if you have any faculty member, any person, no matter what their role is in the organization, and you should value everyone's contributions to the organization, the technical people and the non-technical people, but you should be celebrating all of their accomplishments any way you possibly can. So the quick emails to people, newsletters, talking at the beginning of faculty meeting, showing some slides of accomplishments that people have had. You yourself can feel so proud of what individuals have accomplished and that you've recruited them. But at the same time, they hear the message that, you know, the entire community is celebrating.
I think one of the things, although these are all good comments, is we know the world is less than perfect. So sorry for bringing in some other thoughts about this. I think the subtle issues of differential treatment needs our attention as division directors, chairs, deans, etc. And they're subtle. I think I can quote Daryl Kirch, who was the former president of the AAMC, because he just made that comment in a book that it published, is that when there are these subtle violations of either support or differential treatment and it goes unchecked, it actually sends a message. I think, Valerie, you said it, that, you know, celebrate all. That differential treatment, which may be subtle or not, is actually noted and becomes embedded in the culture. And so I think it's a tough process to actually recognize that and then to correct it if it's happening, and to correct it at the time so that it doesn't perpetuate itself and you maintain a good culture and people feel valued for whatever their unique contributions are.
Thinking about if someone gets a huge grant or a paper in the New England Journal or JCI, people see that and they say, well, I come to work every day and do a good job and do a lot of things, but you know, there, it's hard to, how do I get recognized for that? One thing I tried to do was I incorporated a lot of letters. I had templated letters. And for instance, in my 30 and 90 day check-ins, there was one question was, who has been helpful to you in your entry into our department? And I had a letter that I sent to each person that was listed on those check-ins, because when the division chief did the 30 day and they sent it to the chair's office, I would send a letter to everyone who was thanking them for helping the new recruit get a good start. I also went through all of the teaching evaluations, and I had a certain level, numerical level, that I had a letter thanking them for their efforts in teaching. And then on the annual reviews, I said, who are your mentors? And whoever they listed as a mentor, I wrote them, I had a letter thanking them for mentoring this person. There are a lot of things that go on every day that you can get people to document, and it doesn't take much time to have the letters. I would just, I would sign the letters because they were templated. And, you know, I think, and I encourage people to put it into their promotion dossiers as part of their service to the department, university. So those, what other sorts of recognition did people do to try and retain?
It's really important to have all these positive signs of recognition, but I think that sometimes we overlook and we don't pay enough attention to how we have conversations when people are engaging in behavior that's problematic. They're not being a team player. And I think that it's important to think about those conversations and to present them in a very positive light. People can have behaviors that aren't necessarily making the team successful, that aren't necessarily leading to their success. And those conversations really need to be framed in a way that we're really about making you successful. And this is something that seems to be causing a problem. How are we going to make it so that it doesn't get in the way of your success and our growth as a department? And so I think that's something that we don't really oftentimes pay enough attention to.
The little things make a huge difference. So one of the things that I learned when I was becoming a chair from a prior chair was to write a handwritten note to people when they accomplished something. And I can tell you that at least 20 of my faculty have mentioned that years later. And several of them would open up their drawer and say, here is the note you sent me 10 years ago. And I will always keep this because it reminds me of how much the department, you and the department, cared about me and my accomplishments. And the second thing that I think is important to do is to go to the faculty members' offices. Don't have them come to you. Go to them to show them that you respect them and to also see how they are in their environment, not in yours. So I think the little things do make a huge difference.
From a firm perspective, and then back to Valerie. Advocacy from a firm perspective is a big role we play from a candidate perspective. You know, when you referenced Bruder at the start of the conversation, the biggest turnovers with assistant professors. And I think about fellows coming out of training and going into practice and feeling the need to advocate for themselves with a huge department, right? Or an institution or an HR person. And it's not a skill set they have, right? They've been doing the best they can with what everybody has asked them to do, asking as few questions as possible outside of medical knowledge. And so I can tell you that is a big role we play with our clients is being that advocate for the candidate, because the last thing we want to do is have our client sign somebody who's coming into the relationship with unmet expectations, but they haven't expressed those either. And so I think it's real important that there's just not an assumption because you ask a younger physician to tell you everything they need to be successful. One, they may not do it for fear of offending you. They may not also know what to ask for. You know, we're in a world of short resources, and I think a lot of people in the chair in chief role, maybe hoping that they don't ask for too much, right? Because that then causes a whole nother chain, you know, chain of actions that has to take place. And so I think the advocacy is a big thing, you know, that we've all talked about. And I think the last thing I would say is, since the theme is retention, you know, when you look at a failed search and the impact it has on retention, I just think it's something for us to also think about, because oftentimes there's been an interim for a year, then you do a search, and if that search lasts a year and then that fails, that can have a dramatic impact on the faculty within a division or a department. And we're not talking about divisions of 50 and 60. Oftentimes it's 3 and 4 and 5 in a lot of cases. And so the loss of a single person because of a lack of leadership or because of a lack of enough faculty to meet clinical demand can be catastrophic.
You know, we're talking about proactively when you're actively recruiting someone in a position, but we haven't talked about when you are a new chair or a new division chief and you come into the organization. I would posit that a lot of the loss that you described, Bruder, with those statistics is actually the loss of individuals who were recruited by the previous leader. And I think you have to spend as much time and effort establishing the relationships with those individuals that were not somebody that you directly recruited. There's a huge amount of work that has to be done. And I can tell you from experience, I mean, we all have this experience, you know, you're the new chair and, you know, I don't know you and you don't know me. And how do I know you're going to make good on that, you know, the resources that I was promised from the last chair? Honestly, can take even more work than someone that you've a priori recruited with your division chief or a division chief with your faculty. So I just would throw that out, that retention, it's not just the new people you bring on, it's the individuals who are part of that community that will be relying on you to help them meet their goals and their careers through the journeys that they take with you and that partnership. And that's a hard one to sometimes to establish effectively and not lose really significant faculty. And I would say every faculty member you lose is significant, with the exception that if you're a good chair and a good division chief, you're always wanting the best for your faculty, even if they move on to become a director somewhere else. That's a good feeling. But retentions that are not that feeling are not good. The ones you're trying to, you know, obviate.
There are many people hired in academic pediatrics to lead divisions that actually have not ever spent one-on-one time with all the people in the division. It was a town hall meeting, or it was, you know, and there are leaders with the mindset that it's my decision, not the division's decision. And that impacts how you set the schedule. But when you think about that, if a new chief has not met everybody one-on-one in a division, and sometimes, you know, Chris, if it's 50 people in a NICU division, that's hard to do. I get it, but you can also accomplish it with surveys, you know, individual surveys people can fill out for the new division chief. And my point being, I think the way you force or allow a candidate to engage with the faculty in their division can actually set them up for failure or success, because if the division feels like they didn't have a say, then they may come into a system where the team is working against them from the start. So I just thought that was an important thing as we think about itineraries and recruitment.
By the time I ended my time as chair in Seattle, most of the divisions actually had developed a divisional onboarding process. That the department had its onboarding, but each division and had a process of introducing people to their clinical responsibilities and mentoring them to try to get them off to a good start. I think this was a great session. There's probably a lot more we could say about retention, and maybe that will be a topic of a future conversation. So thank you for listening today.